My name is Robin Linkhart with Community of Christ, and I serve on the Sunstone Foundation Education Board, and we are absolutely delighted to welcome you to the Sunstone Summer Symposium. The opening Smith-Pettit lecture, it is listed as session number 91 in your printed programs. We would especially like to recognize the Smith-Pettit Foundation for their continued generosity in sponsoring this event and so many other important projects in Mormon studies. Each year, the Smith-Pettit Foundation sponsors our opening lecture with the condition that we feature a non-Mormon scholar to share new ideas with our community. This year, we are honored to introduce, as our esteemed 2018 Smith-Pettit lecturer, Ned Blackhawk. Tonight, Ned Blackhawk, an award-winning author and scholar, will revisit American history framed to incorporate a more complete narrative, which includes the impact on and interaction with the indigenous history of these lands. Please note that Professor Blackhawk will be available for a book signing immediately following this evening's lecture. Now, I want to point out a few things to you. We are going to have two books that Ned Blackhawk has authored available at Benchmark, and one is this one, Indigenous Visions, Rediscovering the World of Franz Boas. And the second one, which I believe will be focused this evening, is Violence Over the Land, Indians and Empires in the Early American West. So you can get both of these at Benchmark. I want to make just a few announcements before we begin. First of all, if you haven't silenced your cell phone, please do that now. And while you're doing that, if you haven't purchased your ticket for the 2018 Sunstone Summer Symposium, you can do so at the registration desk outside in the concourse, and it's down on that end. The Sunstone Education Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. As such, we depend on your generous donations. We invite you to please consider making a contribution at the desk, and you can also support Sunstone by purchasing conference-themed merchandise, including lanyard pins. Stephen Carter is featuring them all up and down his lanyard that you can affix to your own lanyard. And those pens feature some of Sunstone's most esteemed scholars, some of whom are among us tonight, and other very prominent figures in Mormonism. Audio for this session and others throughout the conference will be available for purchase at the Sunstone AV desk, also located in the concourse. Now, if you have a smartphone, take note we have an official app for the conference. Instructions on how to download the app are in your printed program, and you can use that handy-dandy app to give lifetime updates throughout the conference, as well as readable docs for sheet music. We have hard copy on your chair that will be in various sessions. Tonight, we want to thank our esteemed musician, Alan Eastman, for serving as Sunstone's official pianist. Mm-hmm. So, Vicki Eastman is going to be assisting us with our hymns. Our opening hymn is Let Justice Roll Down or Draw the Circle Wide. Okay, Draw the Circle Wide, which is a Community of Christ hymn. And Vicki will come up here and assist with teaching us that song. And after we sing, Val Darger will offer the invocation.
Hi, my name is Vicki Eastman. Who am I not? R. Dean Watts? No. Kim McCall? No. I'm afraid you're stuck with me this year. We are going to do some new music through the course of the Sunstone Symposium, coming from three sources. Traditional LDS hymns. We're going to be singing some hymns of the Community of Christ. And we're going to be singing some new hymns that have been generated by a group called the Western Hymn Writers Association, headed up by Fred Voros. So we're going to be doing new stuff this year. So far, we haven't been too successful in getting this to project up on the screen. If you have the Whova app, it downloads after a while. I got it to download, but internet is slow. So on your seats, you should have printed copies of this music. We're going to start with a Community of Christ hymn called Draw the Circle Wide. Now, because this is unfamiliar music to many of you, I am going to ask for a demonstration choir to come up here. If you are a person who likes to sing and you have the ability to sight read hymn kind of music, would you come up here and be part of the demonstration choir? I know there are good singers out there. Ah, here comes one. Come on, Keith, get up here. Ah, Rebecca, is that you? Yes, we do have some good singers. Okay. I have got music for you up here. Oh, come on, some more people. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so if you do not have access to a printed copy, here you go. Oh, what a nice demonstration choir we've got. Look at this. We're so good. If you don't have access to a printed copy, raise your hand and I will have a minion take one to you.
Is that me?
Yes, thank you, Keith. You're the minion. Oh, wait a minute. We need another one here. Okay, so this is a fun, catchy hymn, and it's got a message of inclusion for us all, which is especially good for tonight's topic. So here's what I would like to do. We are going to have Alan play this piece through one time for the demonstration choir, and then I will sing with you, although I'm a lousy singer. I'm a better speaker than I'm a singer. And then the demonstration choir is going to sing the refrain, which is what you see on the first page, and the first verse, which is what you'll see on the second page. And then we'll go back to the first page, and everybody will join in, and we'll all sing the rest of the song, okay? You're going to like this song. This is a popular song with the Community of Christ, and I can't see why. Okay, Alan, why don't you play it through for us? And don't go too fast. He's like a horse that's just ready to race, you know.
Thank you.
demonstration choir, your job's not over. So we have another new song at the end, Let Justice Roll Down. If you need a copy of that, I have it here. Yeah, so be ready to come back up, all of you. If you need a copy of that, stop by here. Thank you, singers. Thank you, singers.
Good evening, everyone. I'm a newbie, so I guess this is my initiation. and while I'm here, I hope everybody doesn't mind. I have a baby nephew who is in open heart surgery as we speak. He's only days old, so I'm going to say a prayer for him as well. Our dear, kind, eternal Father in heaven, we're so thankful for this opportunity and this occasion to meet together and to listen to the speakers who, in their wisdom, have discovered truths that they can share with us. We're thankful for the freedom that we have to do so, and that we live in a country that we are able to live our life and our religion in a way that our conscience dictates. We're thankful for the many gifts and blessings of abundance that we enjoy, and we're thankful especially for one another, for our fellow human beings whom we gather strength from and whom we learn from. We're thankful for your influence in our lives and for the guidance you give us. And we pray that you'll continue to bless us to gain knowledge and intelligence from our experiences. And I ask a special prayer at this time for little Salem Kelch, that he will be made whole and that the surgery will be a success, and that he can go back home to the loving arms of his parents. We pray for the speakers both tonight and for the rest of the weekend that they will be guided in their speech and that those in the audience can gain an understanding and insight into something that they may otherwise not have known, and that we can all be fed and edified. And we pray for your spirit to be around and about us and take us to our homes as we leave in peace and safety. And we're so thankful again for all the many gifts and blessings that we enjoy. And we ask these things in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Ned Blackhawk, Western Shoshone, is currently a professor of history of History and American Studies at Yale. He served on the faculty at the University of Wisconsin in Madison from 1999 to 2009. A graduate of McGill University, he holds graduate degrees in history from UCLA and the University of Washington. Professor Blackhawk is the author of Violence Over the Land, Indians and Empires in the Early American West, Harvard 2006, A Study of the American Great Basin. This publication garnered half a dozen professional awards, including the Frederick Jackson Turner Prize from the Organization of American Historians. In addition to serving in professional associations and the editorial boards of American Quarterly and Ethnohistory, Professor Blackhawk led the founding of two fellowships, one for American Indian students to attend the Western History Association's annual conference, and the other, named after Henry Rowe Cloud, Winnebago class of 1910, for doctoral students working on American Indian Studies dissertations at Yale. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ned Blackhawk.
Uh, Thank you, Robin, for that kind and generous introduction. It's a real honor to be here this evening and to return to Salt Lake, where I've worked in many capacities over the what now seems to be many decades of my academic and scholarly career. I'm particularly proud to be in the company of Forrest Kutch, for example, with whom I worked in various functions about maybe 8 years ago when the University of Utah's Natural History Museum was redesigning itself and moving to a permanent facility that now many of you, I'm sure, know pretty well. It has a permanent exhibit of Native peoples of the region and of Utah that I'm happy to have participated in its formation in some small way. I've also been here many times as a researcher and academic, as we'll see this evening. So it's a real honor to be back in Salt Lake. And I'd like to thank particularly the Sunstone Symposium board members, Holly Alden, obviously Lindsay, who's been shepherding so many of us through this process of organization over the last few, many weeks, in fact. And I'd even like to thank this evening's accompanist. Where did he go? Alan Eastman? Thank you. I've never had the pleasure of working with an accompanist before. Like many of you, I think we're here for both intellectual and personal reasons. And my invitation today comes from that, from a similar space of both personal and intellectual background. I am a Western Shoshone Indian, having just visited, for example, our tribal offices in Elko, Nevada, where many of you, unlike perhaps many of my colleagues and friends in Connecticut, have no idea where Elko is. I'm sure many of you have driven through Elko and perhaps even know Battle Mountain and Winnemucca as well. My daughter attended the Shoshone Language summer program they've been running there over the last few years at Great Basin College, a program that was originally run here at the U. So it's really a pleasure for me to have been able to come here in that capacity. As I write in this first book of mine that Robin so generously introduced and perhaps profiled or publicized in some capacity, my father and grandparents and great-grandparents all hail from the Central Valleys of Nevada. Can you not hear me? I'm sorry. Okay. Well, I'm happy to hold it here as well. Okay, so I was just saying, and I don't want to get too loud, that my family hails, obviously, from the region for many, many generations. And my father, grandparents, and great-grandparents were all raised in the central valleys of central Nevada, at places that some of you may also know, places like Austin, Nevada. Many? No? Okay. Austin may be more familiar. Even people I was just in Elko, the people we stayed with, had no idea where, had never been to Austin either. It's about an hour south of Battle Mountain driving over the speed limit. So my family hails from the Reese River Valley of central Nevada. My grandmother was born in a place called Monitor Valley, which is even less known. And most of our family has spent at some point, or hails from relatives who grew up in and around some place called Smoky Valley, which in the early 20th century had the second largest concentration of Western Shoshone Indians in the world, outside of Oahe, which is on the Nevada-Idaho border, about 100 miles north of Elko, as well as 100 miles from Boise. So we were at Oahe a few weeks ago, my first time actually there. So Oahe may not be intimately familiar to the audience this evening, but my guesses are some of you have heard of it. Smoky Valley and Oahe are the two largest concentrations of Western Shoshone Indians in the early 20th century. And our family history thus goes back a long, long way here in the region. And while I was raised away from the region's sweet fragrances of sage and the endless sunshine and kind of seemingly endless snow-covered mountain peaks in the winter. I have always considered the Great Basin home in some capacity. And I'd really like to begin my talk this evening by recognizing that we are on the traditional homelands of Paiute, Timpanogos Ute, Goshute Shoshone, and other Ute bands who have lived in this region since time immemorial. As I'll explain shortly, my academic career has been indelibly shaped by these personal experiences, as well as by a guiding and enduring sense, maybe a belief and conviction even, that our country does not really fully understand its history, nor the place of Native peoples within it. And I decided at what now seems to be a particularly long, long time ago, in the early 1990s, I decided to try to become an American historian, to challenge this oversight. And I decided to dedicate myself at a young age in college to study Native American history. And somehow, I now teach at Yale University, and I'm starting my 10th year on the faculty. And I've worked closely there with our growing community of Native American students, many of whom have done and are doing incredible work on behalf of their tribes or other Indian communities and organizations. And I take great pride in these successes and in the community that we've established there. And I could talk the entire evening about the exciting programs and many initiatives that we run in various theater programs and various academic programs. And we even have a Native American language program that we've established at Yale that allows our students to study their tribal and heritage languages, doing so through remote technologies with fluent and or nearly fluent tribal linguists across the country. And we do so in New Haven, Connecticut, of all places. And one would not know this unless one were to spend some time looking into the subject. But Native American students have, in fact, excelled at Yale University for over 100 years. And the Henry Rocloud Fellowship that Robin introduced was named after a Winnebago leader from the early 20th century who graduated Yale in 1910, having gone to a boarding school in Nebraska and then being sponsored by missionary families to attend more advanced academic boarding schools in the Northeast. And he eventually ended up at Yale. His best friend was a future senator from Ohio by the name of Robert Taft, class of 1910. The annual year Yale book has a photograph of, it was then an all-men's college, of all the male graduates. And Henry Rocloud's photo recognizes his missionary family as his home address, because he was living with them while he studied, and that's where he took his name, the Roe family name. And he became, as those in my field know, a very dedicated critic of then assimilation era programs designed to eradicate American Indian customs, religions, languages, and other types of community values. Practices that are carried on here in the region at places like the Stewart Indian School in Carson City, Nevada, or Chemawa up in Oregon, other boarding schools. The interesting thing about that yearbook is that Robert Taft's photo, what address do you think is listed as his home address? 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Because his father, Howard Taft, was happening to be sitting in the United States White House as the 28th president of the United States. So that, you know, anecdote or that perhaps footnote or tidbit, I think, you know, which wasn't initially planned and scripted for this talk this evening, might help introduce the theme of this subject tonight. Because like the activities organized in New Haven, Connecticut, of all places, Indian peoples have been central participants in the processes of historical development around them, And we really can't understand much of the Native American past, obviously, but also the non-Native American, or what we might call the American past, without the kind of fundamental recognition of the intertwined nature of these two subjects. And Henry Rowe Cloud would spend the rest of his life, until 1950, four decades, working to reform federal Indian policy. He was the only Native American author on a congressional report chartered in the 1920s called the Merrim Report that exposed the horrific nature of reservation life for most Native Americans, talked about a half century of mismanaged federal policies, and ultimately ushered in, as many of us may have heard, of something called the Indian New Deal of the 1930s. Henry Rowe Cloud's fingerprints are all over that process. He and Robert Taft remained friends. And on more than one occasion, Rowe Cloud took his tribal delegation to visit Washington to lobby on behalf of his community's needs, and met more than once, as did this gentleman here, more than once, with the highest-ranking political leaders in the United States, whom we call presidents. So this history is not one that is unremoved from one another. The presence of Native Americans, obviously, in America is a central and enduring feature of our national landscape and of our national past. As we'll see this evening, even in one of the least studied regions in America, what some have termed or considered to be a black hole of Western history, the American Great Basin, even in the American Great Basin, Native peoples have helped to shape and to define the region's broader history. And if we were to examine in some detail, as we may over the next half hour or so, Great Basin Indian history, we will see fundamental patterns and processes of larger themes of American history more broadly. And we may come away with a conclusion, which may be the central argument or analytical focus this evening. We may come away with a sense that to know Great Basin Indian history on some level is to know American history. So I think it's perhaps not surprising for you to hear that many of my earliest publications featured and focused on the ties between Great Basin Indians and those imperial and Euro-American communities around them. And I spent much of the first 10 years or so of my academic career charting the nature of the changing relationships between, in particular, Spanish colonial societies in New Mexico and later Mexican settlements, and eventually English-speaking territories, states, and even kingdoms throughout the American Great Basin, with sets of Ute, Paiute, and Shoshone peoples in particular. This work began with studies of Spanish relations with particularly northern New Mexican and eastern Colorado Ute bands in the 18th century, and identified a kind of enduring political alliance that was established in the second half of the 18th century between bands of Ute Indians in northern New Mexico and in Colorado, with the Spanish imperial leaders sitting in the governor's palace in New Mexico. Communities that had initially, for over about 100 years, been at war with one another. And so some of us may know that New Mexico is the oldest European colony permanently occupied in North America, founded in the 1590s, chartered in the 1540s, long ago, essentially. New Mexico has been part of other empires longer than it's been a part of the United States. And obviously the region's history reflects these types of dynamics. So this was a pretty academic study in its focus. It was a dissertation. Then became this book called Violence of the Land. And it included a certain choice sentences such as the following. Discussions of Spanish colonialism and Great Basin Indian history rarely occur. And that kind of page-turning narrative was followed by sentences like the following. That as the oldest colonial settlement in North America, New Mexico has a rich and developed historiography that dates to the 19th century. So this was the kind of focus of a regional study that always had at its heart the non-equestrian peoples of the Great Basin, as I eventually came to term the Paiute, Goshute, and Western Shoshone peoples, who inhabited particularly the central Great Basin, west of Salt Lake and east of the Sierras. But really, to understand that history, as I'm going to try to unfold a little this evening, one had to know about these other Indian relationships with these other Europeans. And many of you, obviously, know a great deal about the history of Utah and the history of 19th century Euro-American settlement in the region. Some of us may know that the first recorded Spanish or European colonists who came into the region were Spanish friars who came in the summer of 1776. They visited Utah Lake and met with Timpanogos, whom they called Laguna Utes, the Dominguez and Escalante expedition. Their journals have been translated, I think, 3 or 4 times. Will Backley would know these things better than I would, perhaps. That history is only possible because of that alliance I referenced earlier between Ute Indians and the Spanish, who in the early 1750s had established a treaty, essentially, between themselves that allowed and encouraged, in fact, Spanish settlement and trade into the region. So all of these subjects that are occurring throughout the 18th century are shaped and imprinted by the political influences, the diplomatic, the, we might call them geopolitical, relationships between sovereign communities, people who have recognized jurisdictions, who have standing militaries, who have diplomatic leaders, who make long-term agreements. That history imprints itself then very deeply upon the 19th century, and obviously the 20th, and now 21st, and does so in a whole range of ways that are at the heart of this study. And you can't really see this general map of the Great Basin region. It has kind of shaded regions that show various kind of overlapping spheres of native influences, but and it includes a lot of settlements and towns and battle sites that are at the heart of this region's history, or at least parts of it throughout the particularly 18th and 19th centuries. So these fundamental themes of American history throughout the 18th century are identifiable clearly in this region's history. Political relationships between communities, military encounters, expeditions, trading relationships, and I think Ted Warner's is the most recent translated and edited version published by Utah University Press of the Dominguez and Escalante expedition. It's fascinating. It has really incredible detailed insights into this history that would probably surprise many of us. And many of us may know that the Grand Canyon has a crossing called the Crossing of the Fathers. It's the first known European travel across or through the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon. It's not from the south, however, it's from the north. After the Spanish party decides in the October and the fall of 1776 that they can't actually make it to California. So they cross south into Colorado, and they are on their way back to New Mexico, to the known Spanish Empire, and they encounter herds outside of Hopi and Zuni pueblos. Cattle that they know are held by the tribes in those regions. And they left Abiquiu, which is on the Chama River. We don't think of Abiquiu as kind of central to the history of the Great Basin, but it's really the launching pad to the northwest. The old Spanish trail will head from this region. They leave there on July, in late July of 1776. They don't cross the Crossing of the Fathers, I think, until November. They've been gone a long time. And they had to eat their horses along the way. They had kind of slightly mutinous crew with them. They have no idea where they are. They cast lots south of here at Sevier Lake or Sevier Lake because they're supposed to go to Monterey, where the Spanish have colonized the region as part of the conquest of California that began in 1769. They're supposed to link up these two great colonies, California and New Mexico. That's their mission. So they see these herds, these cattle herds, and their men want to kill them, to eat them. And the friars know that these herds belong to Indians, that they belong to one of these sovereign communities. So they don't. They forbid their party to kill them. That's how ingrained these communities are throughout this 18th century past. That's how ingrained they are in the 19th century as well. So for our attempt to think of them as separate hasn't done Indian, Great Basin Indian history a lot of good, particularly because, as we'll see shortly, the Great Basin has produced a lot of paradigms or categories of analysis or understandings that have often characterized these communities to be timeless, to be ahistoric, to be, in the famous words of Engels or Eric Wolff, that to be peoples without history. So my work has always kind of challenged that perspective, and it's rooted in a fundamental sense and a fundamental experience and even a fundamental faith that I have, that peoples, like a bit, this is my great-grandmother who's featured in this book that I wrote, peoples whose lives have been heavily impacted by Euro-American settlement, in this case mining and ranching in the early 20th century in central Nevada, that destroyed ecologies of gathering, that kind of proletarianized or kind of threw native peoples into wage-earning work, that disrupted hunting of game and consumed water resources in the region, that these practices have imprinted themselves fundamentally upon Indian ways and lives that haven't historically been well understood. So in the Great Basin, these kind of primary linguistic Shoshonean-speaking communities who are heavily often grouped into larger cultural groups like the Western Shoshone, Mike tribe, the Ute tribe, or tribes, the Southern Paiute, many of whom, like this Ute map shows, are bands of different groups who are related but still maintain distinct economic and political and social and cultural practices, that these groups are not outside of history but central to it. Again, the central feature or argument today, Great Basin Indian history is American history. Somehow we've lost that perspective, and partly because this is actually, I was in Carlin, Nevada on Sunday. This is a lithograph of Indian beggars, they're called, at an Overland Trail site in Carlin, Nevada from 1872 that was published in the National News Magazine. These beggars often were seen by early settlers, by early government officials, by early academics and travel writers, including my favorite example is a young Missourian who left Missouri as the Civil War broke out because he didn't want to be conscripted into the Union Army. He'd had some experience growing up along the Mississippi River. He knew how boats worked. He didn't want to join that fight. So what does he do? He lights out for the Western Territory. And his brother, Orion Clemens, had been appointed secretary of the Nevada Territory in 1860 by the Lincoln administration, which had now become the reigning power in Washington. He leaves behind an entire disparaging characterization of those people in the West that he finds very unfamiliar, not just Native peoples, other religious communities, Hawaiians, Chinese miners and migrants in California. He's so disturbed by what he sees out west that he adopts a kind of jocularity to his writing, a kind of new gruff frontiers vernacular. And we don't often realize this, but this young Missourian named Clemens takes his pseudonym, Twain, in Virginia City, Nevada, in 1863, in his first publication in the Territorial Enterprise. So this American writer, whom we celebrate as our nation's greatest author, came of age and literally reinvented himself in the Great Basin. And he did it partly in response to those around him, whom he had no kind of cultural capacity to make sense of or intelligibly process their differences, whether they be religious, whether they be ethnic, whether they be racial. And he called the Shoshone Indians of the Great Basin Overland Trail the most wretchedest man on earth, or the most wretchedest type of human. And this is in Roughing It, his second major work, published in 1871. Twain. This is followed very quickly by early American historians. A little ironically, Frederick Jackson Turner is the most famous American historian who writes about the frontier. Early anthropologists in particular came to characterize these communities as peoples without history. And again, one of these kind of perhaps revealing anecdotes is that the most widely recognized intellectual in the ethnographic world who wrote about this region's native peoples throughout the 20th century was an anthropologist who's now long forgotten or largely forgotten by the name of Julian Stewart, who wrote the great ethnographic history of the region in 1938 called Great Basin Sociocultural, Groups of the Great Basin. He was a Shoshone ethnographer. He traveled around the region. He mapped these communities, kind of cultural practices, and he came to the conclusion, much like Twain, that these communities were so ecologically determined and so dependent upon an annual harvest of pinyon pines, which are the kind of variable harvests, that the nature was so ingrained in their societies that they didn't constitute a kind of formal recognition as an Indian tribe, because they were what he called patrilineal bands. They were involved in a never-ending food quest. They lived life, in his mind, in the most primitive form possible. And the patrilineal band was the smallest form of political organization that he and other anthropologists could recognize outside of or alongside with the Aboriginal communities of Australia. And if you took any anthropology classes or exposed to the study of human evolution throughout the post-war era, you encountered these ideas when you learned about band-level societies, chiefdoms, and larger kind of national states. So this community for Stewart, or these communities, represented the least developed human organizations in human history. To make the claim that they somehow shaped or imprinted themselves upon the history of the American West or of the United States more broadly, he would have considered laughable. The tribe in Elko, where I'm enrolled, was recognized in the 1930s as part of a effort by the new Indian New Deal of John Collier to provide land for landless communities. Some of us may know that there's only one 19th century treaty signed with Indians in Nevada, the treaty that establishes the Owyhee Reservation. The Treaty of Ruby Valley, which all these other tribes are signatories of, these treaties are never implemented. So many of these tribes become attached to white communities at places like Elko or Fallon or Winnemucca, Battle Mountain. They become part of the urban environment and known as colonies. They get recognized in the 30s under this new provision that Henry Rokeload helped establish and other Indian reformers as recognized political communities or tribes. This anthropologist, and this is one of my first academic articles, testifies against their recognition. He says, "Don't baffle them with a constitution or tribal government. These are not tribes in his mind. They're certainly Indians, no doubt about that, but not worthy of that type of political recognition." Fortunately, his recommendations are not followed, and the tribes of Nevada become federally recognized, the vast majority do in the 1930s through this process. So these are the kind of intellectual paradigms, the kind of established scholarly interpretations that existed and still in many ways exist and shaped things like museum exhibitions that hold these peoples to be timeless, to be ahistoric, to be outside of history. You know what? To be different than us, different than those around us. They represent some distant apparition of ourselves. We look to them to see what we are not or what we once were, right? That kind of fundamental difference is established and entrenched in so many ways in this region's history. Twain does it. Julian Stuart does it. Bancroft and the great 19th century American historians do it. And it just continues on. These legacies endure to the point where we can't possibly think that these communities help shape, in fact, defined certain and fundamental ways the world around them. So this project includes a whole set of efforts to counter that narrative, to use the kind of classic practices of historical inquiry, to look at something in time, to look at something in space, and to draw kind of interpretive conclusions from it. It includes a whole range in an appendix of conflicts, in particular, between native peoples and non-native peoples. And so it became kind of my, I guess, professional habit or my commitment or some kind of guiding motivation to try to record these levels of conflict. And the first known appearance of clearly identifiable Ute Indians in Colorado or New Mexico. It's not clear because the Colorado-New Mexican border is not at the time established, though it's over 300 miles and 300 miles long. And Robin, I know you're from Colorado. Colorado thinks of itself as the pioneer state. It shares a 320-mile border with the oldest permanent colony in North America. Those are not easily congruent conceptual frameworks to maintain, I believe. And as we'll see shortly, Colorado's history is deeply, deeply imprinted by both New Mexico, but also the native peoples, particularly Ute Indians, as well as Cheyenne and Arapaho of the region. So what does it mean, and this is the start study of this book that I won't go into too much detail, but what does it mean? The first known appearance of Ute Indians in the Spanish colonial record is a captive raid, which 80 or 80 clearly identifiable Ute Indians are captured by the Spanish government in 1637 at some point, or 1639. A lot of us who study this history know that the Spanish colonial records of New Mexico are very paltry for the 17th century, or the 1600s, because at the end of that century, the Pueblo Indians in Santa Fe and the region rise up in a great revolution or rebellion called the Pueblo Revolt that drives the Spanish from the region for over 12 years. And one of the first things the Pueblos do when they destroy the governor's palace in Santa Fe is they burn their records. So the documentary archive of colonial New Mexico in the 17th century is not that deeply established. So the precision of time and space is less apparent. But over time, we see these kind of recurring raids by the Spanish against these native peoples to the north because they have increasingly become dependent on Spanish colonial technologies and goods, particularly Spanish-introduced horses, which revolutionized the North American landscape across the post-Pueblo Indian revolt period, well into the 20th century. You really can't have the history of the American West the way we think of it without horses. Not just Indians, but others as well. Without horses, introduced by the Spanish and traded by Indians, the history of the American West would not be what it is. Much of the history of North America, in fact. So again, one of those fundamental themes of American history is clearly evident. So the native peoples are coming into the region on foot and trying to acquire horses from Spanish herds, and they're stealing them, and they're running away with them, and the Spanish are chasing after them. Give us back our horses, right? So that kind of dynamic of raiding and trading occurs throughout the first several generations of New Mexican history. It includes all these other battles and raids and all kinds of encounters that occur throughout the both 17th, 18th, and even into the 19th centuries, when even here in Utah, there are clear conflicts between overland traders, Mexican soldiers, as well as settlers themselves here in the region. These occur well into the 19th and even in the 20th century. There's a massacre of a Shoshone band about 60 miles northwest of Elko in a place called Clover Valley, where a group called Shoshone Mike's family is captured and many of them killed by state police. And I consider that, as many do, the last real battle or massacre or military conflict between Indians and non-Indians here in the Great Basin. And so 1911, from 1630 to 1911, we have nearly 300 years of history that has within it various military and violent and political conflicts. And we could chart this history in great detail. This is an amazing document. It's held in the Governor's Palace in Santa Fe, right when you walk in the front doors. It's a hide painting from 1720 that shows an unspecified battle between equestrian Indians on horse. You can't probably see this so clearly with the lights on, but there's a group of non-Indians here without horses, and they're being attacked by other Indians on horses. And you can kind of see that the Indians on horses have like these strange shapes on their horses, which are leather forms of armor. They're carrying all these blue implements that look like, and are in fact, Spanish swords. They have on their spears metal tips, and they're kind of attacking in a kind of formation. And you have a small group of Indians here without those objects, without leathers, without horses, without medals, and they have a group of women and children on a nearby palisaded hilltop or mesa, whom they're trying to protect. And so these conflicts are not just between Indians and Europeans, but often between Indians and themselves and each other. And so that kind of violent history is in many ways at the heart of much of the work that I've been, and others have been trying to study. And some have even suggested that groups like the Comanche and other Shoshonean-speaking people who migrate into New Mexico as part of this history in the early 1700s, who are first recorded by Spanish governors in 1706, who adopt equestrianism perhaps as well as any other Indian peoples or along on par with them, and they raid deep into Mexico for over really a century, that this giant region known as Comancheria is in many ways under their vassalage and dominion. These are the types of histories that people in my field and I are trying to expose in order to really help recenter more conventional approaches to American history that see American history as moving from east to west, that see American history often beginning with the U.S. nation state in 1787 or 1776 and moving west into western territories without understanding the history of those western territories. And the Comanche dominated the New Mexican-Texas borderlands throughout the late 18th and early 19th century to such an extent that if you one wanted to go from Santa Fe to San Antonio or New Orleans, one could never go across Comanche Rio without their consent. One would travel south to Potosi or some other places and then east. New Mexico had over a million sheep as part of their growing pastoral economy in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Many scholars now suggest that those sheep are helped fuel the rise and maintenance of this economy, where native peoples would come and either demand, trade, or simply take New Mexican herds of cattle, sheep, and horses. And particularly the Hispano communities in Texas are held under such a kind of state of incredible political instability that by the time the U.S. is coming into the region in the 1830s, or Anglophone-speaking settlers like Stephen Austin and Sam Houston, they are in many ways welcomed, as are overland traders like Carson and others in New Mexico. Because of the inability of Mexico as a republic to keep these communities under some degree of social and economic and political stability because of Indian battle. So many of the subsequent battles between the United States and these other native peoples are occurring in the aftermath or as part of other ongoing wars that have been occurring for quite some time. So as I was writing this project about the Great Basin, I'm in New Mexico, I'm in Colorado, intellectually that is, I'm doing research at the Spanish Archives, I'm going to the Nevada Historical Society in Reno, I'm here and looking at some oral histories that are part of the Doris Duke collection at the University of Utah, at the Colorado Historical Society, trying to make sense of this larger region's history. By the time the American state arrives, or overland travelers or state officials, it's occurring to me, as it's evident, but it just didn't really hit me, particularly through correspondence between territorial leaders and government officials in Washington, that several of the most decisive military encounters in this region are occurring on the perimeters of the region that I'm most interested in the central and eastern portions of the Great Basin. And if one were to think about the Civil War in the West, one would know that there are three really principal conflicts at Sand Creek in Colorado in 1864, in Canyon de Chelly or among the Navajo, the Long Walk is initiated in the summer of 1864. And those of us here in Utah are probably familiar, have heard of the Bear River Massacre in January of 1863 that occurs out of the forces come here out of Camp Douglas or Fort Douglas, but they head north and attack a northern Shoshone community in the winter of 1863. So three really profoundly important, almost culminating military conflicts are occurring on the perimeters of this region's history. And it turns out, obviously, they all shape the Indian peoples, not only in battle, but also those nearby. And it turns out, in the kind of history of Colorado that I'm going to conclude with, that there are also Indian peoples participating in these battles on behalf, not so much of the U.S. military, but on behalf of themselves. And the political and diplomatic achievements that they reap in the aftermath of that have largely been forgotten, or at least often lost by regional historians. We may know then about the Bear River Massacre, which was for a long time simply a battle site in Idaho. It took a long time for it to be reclassified. The sesquicentennial of this conflict was recently commemorated in January of 2013. That doesn't seem too long ago to me, but I guess that's now over 5 years ago. But at the time, the nation was going through a larger sesquicentennial commemoration about what the Civil War meant. And these Indian conflicts were losing, hardly garnered much attention outside of the regions in which they occurred. So many of us were active in trying to kind of draw or renew attention to these subjects to try to distill larger legacies and influences of their effects. And it was pretty clear that there weren't a lot of kind of commemorative efforts occurring outside of the Shoshone community and Bear River and or those affected from Bear River at Fort Hall, and that there could have been perhaps a larger regional commemorative effort. Perhaps a kind of recognition that Edward Patrick Connor, the colonel who commanded the forces out of Fort Douglas and who later became a general, maybe doesn't deserve such commemoration. In my interest in Nevada, I kind of uncovered that he, on his way to Bear River and Camp Douglas, had, on his way from California, he was an Irish U.S. military officer during the Civil War. He had also fought along the way out of Fort Ruby, various Shoshone communities in ways that haven't been fully recognized or even detailed in a lot of ways. So these three principal conflicts, Bear River in the north, Canyon de Chelly in the south, which is led by another Missourian, another kind of individual whose history is deeply, deeply a part of this narrative that I'm trying to tell this evening, a Missourian who is illiterate, unlike our friend Samuel Clemens, who will follow him a few years later west. A young Missourian by the name of Carson has come out west as a kind of guide and trapper. And as the beaver fur trade declines in the early 1840s, he's heading back east, and he runs into an overland U.S. military party under the leadership of John Fremont. And he joins Fremont's party as its guide, and Will Bagley is sitting here in the room and has written many studies and things on the mountain men. Carson, Christopher Kit Carson, will then become one of the most famous Americans of the Civil War era, perhaps the most famous Westerner, because of his service on behalf of the U.S. military and its expeditions during the war, or during the antebellum era, and during the war, after he's been Indian agent at Taos, where his primary charges are the Ute Indians of northern New Mexico and of the Park regions of Utah, Carson will join the U.S. military, unlike Samuel Clemens, and participate as a equestrian leader. And he'll bring those Ute Indians with him who understand that serving alongside their trader, serving alongside their agent, serving alongside their ally might potentially serve them well. So again, Carson is deeply and understandably vilified among Navajo and many New Mexican historians for his service on behalf of the U.S. government, which invaded for the first time in post-contact American history the stronghold of the Navajo Nation or Dene at Canyon de Chelly, and burned the peach orchards, as Dee Brown and others have kind of detailed in great form, and subdued the Navajo, which had been kind of a 100-year challenge of sorts for the Spanish, and then marched them by the hundreds and eventually thousands from the Fort Defiance to Fort Sumner, or a place called Bosque Redondo, where they lived for 4 years in a kind of undecided fate of misery, and eventually return in 1868. That history, which again the Ute Indians of Colorado and northern Utah are centrally involved in, or are involved in to such an extent that it has deep influences, is occurring right at the same time. The Sand Creek Massacre is occurring on the plains of Colorado. And Colorado's territorial governors, like the territorial governors of New Mexico, like the territorial governors, including Brigham Young initially in Utah, are deeply and centrally involved in the kind of, you know, challenge of managing Indian affairs. So unlike all these other Indians, in Colorado, northern New Mexico, a group called the Capote Utes, eventually migrate north and start settling in the Park Valleys and in the western slopes of the central Colorado Rocky Mountains. And they maintain this level of autonomy to such an extent that during the late Mexican period, they're inviting Hispanic settlers to settle places like the San Luis Valley and other regions. And this may seem really hard to kind of, and it took me almost 10 years to understand aspects of this subject. But when they, like the Comanches' ability to keep New Mexico in a state of instability, to harvest their sheep, perhaps their cattle, to take their horses, when the Utes are inviting these Hispanic settlers, a Martinez family out of Abiquiu is the largest group, to live in their Ute territory, to live essentially among them, at times of scarcity, they will essentially raid these Hispanic settlements upon their lands. They will deprive them of their provisions. Now that seems congruent with the history that we've been talking about, Indians trying to feed themselves or survive economic hardship by violent or various types of extractive mechanisms. Well, when one group of people have a kind of dominion over a region and are receiving tribute from a group of invited settlers upon it, we might think of that differently than simply indigenous hostility or belligerence. And it's ironic because I was just seeing on the billboard outside that the Utah bar exam was held in this building over the last couple of days. One might not see that as a kind of legal practice, but essentially that's a civil tax. And there's been a recent debate in Indian country about the degree to which tribes have the ability to exercise civil jurisdiction on non-tribal members upon their lands. And there was a Dollar General chain store on Indian lands in the South a couple years ago who basically said that the tribe didn't have any jurisdiction against their employees on their lands over a case. And so that case, the question of who had jurisdiction made it to the Supreme Court, and there's a long kind of history of litigation and legal questions in this country about criminal cases. And there's a great novel by Louise Erdrich called The Roundhouse, and a whole recent kind of series of exposés about, the Denver Post did a great series of stories about 10 years ago on crime in Indian country, and how certain crimes are classified as federal crimes that only the federal government can prosecute. So there's a whole body of case law, essentially, then, on crimes on Indian lands. But what about civil cases or non-criminal harms, as lawyers might call them? Well, these groups are extracting tribute, or what we might call taxes, from settlers upon their lands in a practice that feels a lot like a civil form of sovereign authority that is both exercised by the tribe receiving their sheep and condoned or at least tolerated by the settlers. So these are kind of questions of history that have perhaps legacies to them that were kind of hard to really gauge for me at the time and still are. But so here in our second to last slide are survivors or participants or historical agents who've lived through by 1868 in March when this photo was taken. They've lived through not only there, but their families and their grandparents and their great-grandparents. They've lived through several centuries by 1868, you know, at least since the 1660s, two centuries of profound changes that have come following the Spanish settlement of New Mexico in the 1590s, following these initial captive raids that the Spanish are conducting into regions, following these horse economies that are establishing. Over two centuries of change have come to Colorado and northern New Mexican Ute Indians. By the time this photo is taken, it's taken by the great Civil War photographer named Matthew Brady, and it comes right as the U.S. government is entering into one of these political agreements with Indians that will be codified by the U.S. Senate in a treaty. And it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks when I kind of started seeing that this treaty, which gets ratified the same day the Navajo Treaty gets ratified of 1868. So the Navajo have been rounded up, conquered, and almost entirely forcibly marched several hundred miles from their homelands in the Four Corners regions east of the Rio Grande to a military base called Fort Sumner. They've been held there for 4 years, and eventually their leaders and their allies agree, their political non-Indian political allies agree to a treaty that will recognize their sovereignty over a portion of their former homelands in what is now the Navajo Nation, the largest reservation in the United States. It hit me like a ton of bricks when the Ute Reservation is ratified in Colorado on the same day. And that map, which I could only find a photo from 1879 of, or not a photo, but a diagram, it's led by, as many of us may know, the great 19th century Ute leader Ouray, who, it's not clear exactly where, at least in the documentary record, where he was originally born and raised, but eventually becomes leader of the Colorado Ute bands, navigates this complicated world of the Civil War, the end of the Mexican period, the rise of Colorado mining in the 1850s, settlements around him. He navigates this world with a degree of political acumen that, you know, seems, at least in my limited deep study of the region, kind of unmatched in the region's history. He will go. There will be many attempts to get a treaty signed between his people and the U.S. government. Many of them fail because these agreements are hard to maintain, especially if your followers don't always understand or accept the provisions. Similarly with the U.S. government, it's trying to initiate agreements. So he comes to Washington in 1863. Treaty doesn't get ratified. He comes in 1868. Guess who's with him? Christopher Carson. He hasn't been east of the Mississippi in almost 20 years. He's kind of greeted as a celebrity. He writes an autobiography in the 50s that kind of catapults him into... He's illiterate. It's ironic that he writes an autobiography. But his travels with Fremont are compiled into a overland narrative, and his tales are essentially commercialized. So much so that many overland travelers carry his biography with them. One of whom, whose name escapes me, is captured by nearby resident Indians, I think, in the southern plains. And the returning party finds his biography among her possessions. So he's old. He's about 59 by now. He's not feeling well. He comes east partly to try to get medical treatment. He's married his third wife, Josefina, I think, Espino, prominent family in Taos. They've moved to Colorado, where after the war, he's been a prominent U.S. military leader. He's looking for work. He's at Fort Lyon, a small fort that doesn't really have a lot of historic notoriety about it, except it will be the scene of his death 2 months later. I speculate, with very limited evidence, because I can't find the hotel records in Washington, it's conceivable Carson and Ouray roomed together at the Washington Hotel where the treaty was signed on March 2nd of 1868. This is his second time to Washington. He'll come two more times. 1880 is his last trip, I believe, and it comes right after the kind of great conflict that forever rewrites this region's history from a Native American perspective, at least. It breaks out at the White River Agency on the northern portion of the Indian Reservation, which in 1879 still dwarfed the Navajo Nation. The largest Indian reservation of the 20th century, United States, the Navajo Nation, the largest Indian reservation of the 21st century, the Navajo Nation, was dwarfed by a Ute reservation ratified by the U.S. Senate on the same day that created the Navajo Nation. So it's okay, think about what ultimately are then the many legacies or insights that one can be gleaned from these histories. Carson's life was imprinted by many Indian peoples. Ouray's life, he dies before the ultimate vanquishment of this reservation, as many of us may know. But they, because of a series of Colorado territorial initiatives that probably didn't have constitutional standing, this Bruneau Agreement from 1873, an agreement extracts 10 million acres from the Ute Indian Reservation that had previously, from 1868 at the time of its ratification to 1873, this Bruneau Agreement included roughly the western quarter, almost a third of the state of Colorado. So again, Colorado sees itself as a pioneer state that doesn't seemingly have any semblance of connection to the region's Indian affairs. But the region's Indians were clearly and heavily imprinted and affected by Colorado territorial state settlement. We can't fully digest or distill the innumerable sets of legacies that endure from these dramatic 19th century histories. But hopefully, in spaces such as these, communities are coming together to rethink kind of long-held, potentially misunderstood subjects and to develop new approaches that might have more empirical or capacious or perhaps inclusive threads to them that might weave different types of tapestries. In my life in academic career, we're trying to reform an institution that hasn't historically been ultimately that conducive to Native American students and studies, despite Henry Rokleid's achievements. The great architect of federal Indian policy of the late 19th century, Richard Henry Pratt, is a Yale grad. Henry Dawes, a Massachusetts senator, attended Yale. So these are some of the architects of this program of assimilation that deeply imprinted itself on Indian affairs. These tapestries, however, are evident throughout the society in which we live. We, in fact, are living through a profoundly new, though still undetermined, era of federal Indian affairs and relations, one that, when you think through it and kind of juxtapose it with its previous moments, is really kind of astonishing in its revelatory potential insights. Tribes that were fated for what were known as political termination, often led by Western senators like Arthur Utah's Cold War senator, Arthur Watkins, who came to the Menominee Reservation in 1955 and tried to convince them that federal oversight of Indian affairs was a hindrance to their self-actualization, and that if they were to become part of the state of Wisconsin rather than overseen because of their treaties with the federal government, that they would enjoy a new era of prosperity. And that was one alternative that was suggested in the throughout the post-war era. Activists, leaders, tribal community members organized against such kind of policy initiatives and inaugurated this era of self-determination that we now are now entering its almost fourth full decade of actualization. It's, however, threatened often by congressional action, court reinterpretations, and potentially even executive order that might redefine this fundamental relationship that defines the nature of our nation and particularly fundamentally defines the nature of Native American experience within this nation. So much is to be gleaned from these types of historical exposés and analyses. I hope there's been some degree of kind of percolated interest around these subjects here this evening. They are relatively academic in form at times. I'm happy to offer some perspectives after about the at least early years of Mormon Indian relations as I best understand them. They are complicated, as I've been telling a few Sunstone board members recently, by a complexity that may not be fully evident or recognizable. But the Mormon kingdom that emerges here in 1847 and is threatened at times by Indian conflicts in the early years is one that is among other kind of political and confederated and territorial regional powers that are vying for certain types of supremacy in the region that may not be fully well understood or integrated into the region's history. And we may all know that the federal government is not extremely happy with this kind of initiative throughout the first 10 years of Mormon settlement and sends a quarter of its own army to the region in 1857 and 1858 to reoccupy the region as an exertion of federal authority. So there are many different sovereigns, we might say, or at least several, trying to exert a certain type of political authority in the region in these early years that I'm happy to kind of talk at some length, but not in great detail since it's not the precise nature of this evening's presentation. I'd like to thank, I don't know if Lindsay's still here, but I'd like to thank the organizers one more time and to bestow a deep, heartfelt sense of gratitude for your sustained attention and potential further inquiry that may follow this abbreviated or short presentation of Great Basin Indian History this evening. It's been a real pleasure and honor to be here this evening, and I'm happy to answer questions either in a kind of formal setting or after, when I know some of you may have interest in talking about various degrees of this long-standing and shared history. Thank you so very much.
Who's on the mics? Is this open? On? No? Can you hear me if I speak loud?
I think so.
Okay, we can take about 3 questions. If you have any questions, if you'll come to the front, we have one here, and we have one here, and we have one there. Things. So these 3 come to the front, and then Professor Blackhawk, if you would repeat the question into
sure.
the mic before you answer.
Hello. Okay, I was just asked a question about if I have any comments about the Bears Ear National Monument and National Park challenge that is upon us at the moment. I'm not deeply involved in this challenging subject, and I know that there is a consortium of regional tribes who have initially, I think, worked in some capacity with the National Park Service to establish a kind of land use management practice that was moving towards National Park formal verification or recognition, I believe. That has recently been challenged by the new presidential administration, I believe, and there is some extractive resource practices that are now being considered, if not fully implemented. So that's the kind of, I think, background descriptive overview that I think most would recognize. And if I'm mistaken, please forgive my misunderstandings. What I would say is that it's interesting that non-federally recognized land is entering potential partnership with not single but multiple tribal government communities. And those are the types of, I think, forward-thinking, at least in my own personal view, kind of political or land use strategies that might seem generative as a kind of model or lesson. There are longstanding histories that are painful for many tribal communities. I think we can understand that these Ute Indians are forcibly removed from Colorado and resettled in Utah, as many of us may know. In Nevada, where my tribe is, there are a lot of histories of painful histories and experiences around communities that were never given promised reservation lands and watched extractive resources or ranchers or other relative newcomers change the lands without their consent, involvement, or compensation. Perhaps the most famous or ongoing controversy from this period is in the South Dakota territories. And I know that we have a Lakota community member here and who can perhaps share insight into this. And the reason I'm belaboring this or talking at some length about it is because there are perhaps remedies that we haven't thought through or envisioned for these ongoing challenges. Maybe others have, but maybe we're just not talking enough about them. Because there is a treaty signed also in 1868 at Fort Laramie, which just had its sesquicentennial commemoration, and it's a very painful history because the Fort Laramie Treaty, actually in 1851, this treaty. There's an initial effort by the U.S. government to sign a great treaty for the Northern Plains tribes that may have saved, you know, lives and potentially subsequent generations of hardships, but it didn't work. And one of the interesting things I kind of uncovered at this preliminary investigation I was doing was that Brigham Young was trying to get various Indian leaders to attend the Fort Laramie Treaty and was offering Mormon stagecoaches for Indians to travel to this gathering. But the Ute Indians of central Utah were at some degree of conflict with Shoshone Indians in Idaho and Wyoming, whose lands they would have to travel through. And so they refused that kind of invitation. And I think I have a citation to this if someone is really interested. But I, again, thought of that as a very revelatory example, that the stagecoach could be provided to an Indian leader. I think this is before Walkara's War of 1853 really kind of consolidates authority in the region. But the second Fort Laramie Treaty essentially establishes the Great Sioux Reservation across what was once a very expansive, kind of comparable reservation holding to the Utes. And it's violated, essentially, by Black Hills gold rushers in the 1870s that leads to the Great Sioux War and subsequent battle at the Little Bighorn and the roundup of Sitting Bull and other Lakota leaders, and tries to forcibly and does successfully over time return them to the reservation, where there are now five Lakota reservations created out of what was once one single vast domain in South Dakota. Well, that was, it turns out, against the provisions of the treaty. The treaty is the clause of the U.S. Constitution, holds treaties to be the highest law of the land. And the U.S. government over time says, okay, well, that was an unconstitutional taking. There's a claims process established in the second half of the 20th century where tribes can sue the federal government on behalf of outstanding land claims. I don't know actually what happened in the Utah case that well. But the tribes in Nevada just recently accepted this settlement after decades. The tribes in South Dakota are not willing to settle. That's what they keep saying, right? Who holds this land in South Dakota? Just like who holds the Bears Ears? If these are federally governed territories, in my mind, BLM, I think Teddy Roosevelt National Park, Black Hills National Forests, you know, perhaps there can be different arrangements envisioned or at least discussed. But at the moment, we're not often having these conversations. And meanwhile, so these developments occur. So Bears Ear, when I first heard about it, was interesting from the fact that these coalition of tribal groups and the federal government had initially attempted some kind of land management practice, I believe. And I'm only hearing this from newspapers and things, so I'm sure there's others with a lot more familiarity with the subject. So that seemed to me a kind of a promising moment of possibility, but I really have very limited understanding of the current state of the situation. Last question. Yes, I'm gonna. It's almost 11 o'clock in Connecticut, so I'm gonna forget Kino's first name.
Francisco Estuvio
Aquino. Okay, thank you. And he's the subject of Bolton's Padre on a Horseback. Yeah. Correct. Okay, so Herbert Bolton is the kind of great quintessential Spanish borderlands historian who first. He wasn't the first editor of the Dominguez and Escalante journals, but he was the second. And he's the first one to traverse their lens, to retrace their route. And so he drove, and I think Utah Historical Quarterly published these journals in 1953. They did a special issue of his reissued journal, and then it got published in 54. And so the reissued journal has both the original map by their cartographer, Pedro de Mira, and also then Bolton's contemporary map, which is wonderful for people interested in these things. If you really want interested in history of the Great Basin or Colorado-Utah region, highly recommend Herbert Bolton's, though the title is, again, part of a different era, Pageant into the Wilderness. He doesn't pay a lot of attention to the Indians along the way, but there's a lot of information there, so you can glean them. He did something similar with Kino's work on Padre on a Horseback. Kino is mainly trying to connect the Spanish mission world of northern Mexico with the California mission, and does initiate several of the overland travels to California. Most of the Spanish settlements of California are being settled by Pacific Galleon forces, but settlers and padres and californios, as they'll become known. Kino is really interested in one of the kind of mysteries of, there are many, in my mind, mysteries of Western history, but Arizona is kind of one of them, as you're kind of suggesting. The Colorado River is not, again, conventionally or heavily studied. And there's I think Arizona has 22 federally recognized tribes in it. And the Navajo and Hopi and Apache dominate like 95% of the literature on the subject. So there are other Indians in Colorado or in Arizona other than the Navajo, Apache, and Hopi and Zuni communities. But many of them are in the Colorado River. And they have, again, like the Colorado Utes, a kind of surprising degree of autonomy throughout this period and maintain still to this day. Surprising, I think, degrees of authority and cultural integrity and various forms of sovereignty that we would, I think, will all be well understood or would all be well served knowing about. Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, these states all have very distinctive pasts, as we all know here. And I think the kind of comparative differences between them really shed insight into kind of contemporary concerns in ways that we may not readily sometimes gauge. And every time I come from Nevada to Utah, I sense that divide very powerfully. I'm always deeply amazed at how little Nevadans know about their history. And I'm always, I think, deeply impressed by how much Utah citizens seemingly know about their past. So on that note, let me thank you again, and I'm happy to talk further after.
Thank you. I'm sorry I went over.
I want to thank Professor Blackhawk once again for this illuminating, deepening, and broadening of our understanding of the history of these lands. So let's give him another round of applause. We will close by singing Let Justice Roll Down. Is Vicki here still? Or are we going to? Okay. Take us away, Vicki. You should have a copy nearby or open your app, and you can open the doc. And our Sunstone board chair, Bill McGee, will close us with the benediction following the song.
Okay, could I have the demonstration choir come up again? I've got copies of music here for you. If you can get the Hoover app going on your phone and you click on this session, you will see that the PDF of this song is available that way on tablets and on smartphones. Otherwise, look for a piece of a paper nearby. Is this all that's left of my choir? Come on up here. Anybody need music? Okay. This is a song written by the estimable Fred Boros, who is not able to be at Sunstone this year. But he's on a major hymn-writing jag. And this is one of his good ones. So what I would...
I'm going to steal this for a second because we need tenors and basses as well as the ladies. This one is really in four-part hymn form, but it doesn't sound like a conventional hymn when you get going. While she's doing that, let me go ahead and play it through for you so you can hear what it sounds like.
Because of Professor Blackhawk's talk and my personal fury about the bear's ears situation, I think justice should roll down. So here's our plan for singing this song. The first verse will be sung by our demonstration choir. The second verse will be sung by everybody. Then we'll have an interlude. And then I'm going to divide the group in two. On this side of this aisle is group one. On this side of the group is group two. So on verse three, God will make the promise sure will be sung by group one, and group two is going to sing, Roll, Lord, Let It Roll, and then group one will sing, No More Rich and No More Poor, and group two will sing, Roll, Lord, Let It Roll, and then we'll all sing the chorus, and then we'll all sing verse 4. Got that? Okay, here we go.
Thank you. Father in heaven, we're grateful for the opportunity to come gather together and learn more about this region and the peoples who lived here and all of thy children. We pray that thou bless us with desire to know more, with compassion and sensitivity to the issues that are still being wrestled with, and with the desire to reach out and make changes so that more lives can be blessed and all people can enjoy the blessings and benefits of this world and all that is in it. And we pray for this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.